You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
Hey, it's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters, closest to the stars. And this is episode 349 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I know you enjoyed greatly last week's episode 348, Rebuilding and Reimagining Colombia's Tourism Industry with Brian Murphy. He certainly has some things to say, and I think it was a nice back and forth between myself and Brian talking about, I think, deeper things in Colombia. A big thank you to those of you out there who have signed up for the Patreon campaign. I left it fallow a little bit for a few months this year, and I was considering cancelling it, but actually there has been increased interest in the Patreon campaign, and thank you to Adam Nunn and to Adriana Cadavid, who's in Norway and Adam's in the US, for their very kind and very generous sponsorship of the Columbia Calling podcast. So we will continue to work on that end. And there was merchandise on the Patreon website, Columbia Calling merchandise on the Patreon website for long-term as contributors to our campaigns. I've set this up so early in 2021, those of you who pledge $25 or above per month will be getting some free merchandise there, complimentary merchandise with Columbia Calling emblazoned all over it, stickers, mugs, t-shirts, and so on. So thank you again for all of those of you involved. So we'll leave you in the capable hands of Emily Hart with this week's newscast, and then we'll come back with Rick Dragon, who'll be talking to us from the region of Sumapaz about his, retreat. It's an artist's retreat up there near to Sumapaz, the region of Sumapaz, in a town or near to a town called San Bernardo. And his place is called Arte Sumapaz. And check it out, artesumapaz.org. Thank you always for listening, and don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of November 2nd, 2020. On Monday of this week, a protest by former guerrilla arrived in Bogota. Around 2,000 former combatants of armed group the FARC and hundreds of citizens in support arrived at the Plaza de Bolívar to demand that the Colombian government act to stop the murder of former guerrilla. 236 have been killed since the signing of the peace agreement in 2016. The Minga, the indigenous social protest which reached Bogota last week, has now returned to the Cauca. Though Duque refused to engage in talks, spokespersons said that they considered the demonstration a success, as it had demonstrated the president's misrule. In other protest news, a court has ordered that the national police suspend the use of chemical weapons against social protests. Police are now banned from using pepper spray or tear gas, both of which have been key tactics used against protests in recent years. A referendum has been launched in an attempt to remove President Duque from power. Centre-right Senator Roy Barreras formally registered a committee which seeks to force Congress to remove the president from office. According to the senator, the measure is justified by the government's lack of response to the coronavirus, a public security crisis, and Duque's reluctance to implement the 2016 peace deal. In order to be successful, Barreras will need 2 million signatures and then the approval of the State Council. In other moves towards political change, former President Álvaro Uribe, immediately upon his release from house arrest, launched a referendum on constitutional change, which would, among other things, abolish or rebuild from scratch Colombia's Transitional Justice Court, the JEP, which was a key element of the peace deal with the FARC. A new political party has been born in Colombia. Dignidad, meaning dignity, has been formed from a schism on the political left, led by Leonidas Gómez. This is all in a context of decreasing polarization in Colombia, with more citizens than ever identifying as centrist. According to a new poll, only 25% of Colombians identified themselves as either left or right. The vast majority identifies with neither. Massacres in Colombia continue, with 3 victims in the Cauca and 5 more in Sucre last week. Three indigenous people from the Amazonas region were also killed in a violent eviction, which displaced more than 600 families. Colombia has now registered nearly 32,000 deaths from coronavirus and well over a million cases, 72,000 of which are active. The country is seeing a 3% mortality rate from the virus. As the country moves towards a second infection peak, President Duque ruled out another indefinite lockdown, naming it a social and economic suicide. He did, however, recommend that Christmas was brought forward, considering early Christmas bonuses for employees and asking people to do their shopping in November to avoid crowding in December. The economy, however, continues to suffer, and hunger is rising. 6.9 million households ate three meals a day before the pandemic, but at the start of last month, that number was down to 5.5 million. Cartagena has been hardest hit. 81% of the population formerly ate three meals a day. That number is now at 40%. That was the week's newscast, and now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
And this is the third segment of the Columbia Calling podcast. This week, my very special guest is Rick Dragon. He's originally from California, but via, I guess, Georgia, upstate New York. And now he's in the region of Sumapaz, that's in the south of Bogota, well, to the south of Bogota. Not Sumapaz, the Altiplano itself, but in the region of Sumapaz. And he's created something known as Arte Sumapaz, which I think is sort of an artist collective out there 3 hours to the south of Bogota. And, well, we want to know how a digital marketing entrepreneur in another lifetime became, the executive director and co-founder of Arte Sumapaz in Colombia. So welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast, Rick.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be here.
Well, I know you're a long-time listener because we've had messages go back and forth, and now you're down here, and I've been invited down to the place, but obviously something happened this year, as I said last week, and it's become a little bit more difficult. Mobility is tough, but so tell us a little bit about Arte Sumapaz and how you've been weathering the storm.
Oh boy, those are big questions. There are a lot of questions in there. To give you the cliff notes, I've been an artist all my life. I studied art in university. I've pretty much dedicated my life to art. But like a lot of artists, we have to figure out sometimes ways to make a living. And that is not me torturing the child outside the door. When I was very young, and my wife and I lived in the Catskill Mountains of New York, I did everything to make a living. I painted houses, I did construction, all the normal things that artists do to get by. And when I was about 36, this phenomenon of the internet hit. And at that point, small businesses had to be convinced that they needed a website. And so I started a little shop that created websites, and we grew it. And we just happened to be in the revolution, the digital revolution, at just the right moment. And we grew that business and grew it and became like a 30-person shop. And then I co-founded another company that did digital marketing and eventually social media marketing as it came about. Now, you got to remember, at this point, there are no textbooks on the subject. There are no programs at universities for this subject. It's brand new. And I was right there with my company doing this stuff. And I ended up writing a book for McGraw-Hill, two books. I ended up traveling the world as a speaker. I ended up as an adjunct professor at NYU teaching digital marketing. Really had this crazy, wonderful adventure. But I was like always looking over my shoulder going, well, how do I get back to making art? And eventually the opportunity arose to sell the company and make just enough money that if I stayed in the United States, no, I would have to go back to work. But if I looked outside the country, if I followed the advice of so many and I earned dollars and spent pesos, wow, I could just focus on my art. And I had met a Colombian in the United States, and like many Colombians, there's an extreme pride for the country, all the stories and the pride. And I was like, this sounds like an interesting place. And so I took a trip down to Bogota. I was sort of looking at various, there's like three probably major cities in South America that are economical, politically stable, and have large creative communities. But Bogota was my first destination, and I visited Bogota. And you know San Felipe, I walked up and down the streets until I had blisters on my feet, and I saw all the galleries and all the museums. And, you know, Bogota is a chaotic city. It's noisy. It's got garbage on the streets. It's, you know, it's dangerous in places. And I fell in love. I was like, this place is perfect. Why go looking in Mexico City or Buenos Aires? I like this place. So a year later, I moved down to Bogota. And of course, that's why I was listening to your podcast religiously, you know, trying to get insight into this crazy place that I've decided to move to. And I packed up everything. I had sold my company and I moved to Bogota. And I lived in Bogota for 3.5 years in La Macarena. Absolutely loved it. It's a wonderful place. I had an enormous studio very close to San Felipe and Siete de Agosto. But always in the back of my mind, for years, I've had this other little crazy dream. And it came about because when I was very young, I had discovered the great 2-volume set of pedagogical notebooks by the great artist Paul Klee, when he was the foundation teacher at the Bauhaus. And in fact, the Bauhaus, you know, during World War II, it disbanded, and a lot of the professors went to the United States, and they became founders of places like the Cranbrook Academy, and probably more importantly for me, Black Mountain College, this wonderful experimental college in the mountains of North Carolina. So these were huge influences for me, and these alternative ways of teaching art. And I've taught art all my life, and I've developed quite a portfolio of different approaches. And I wanted to share that with young artists here in Colombia. I had met a lot of young art students coming out of university, and arts education in Colombia, while there's some wonderful, wonderful professors here, a lot of interesting stuff, there's this huge chunk of approach to art that I felt was missing. So the dream was, let's create an alternative art school and share these things. And to that end, I bought an old used Renault Logan, and a friend and I, we drove outside Bogota, all the pueblos outside Bogota. Our goal was to be within 3 hours of the city, the capital city. And we checked out Chuachi, La Mesa, a lot of different little pueblos, and we sort of had the viewpoint of we wanted a place with a spectacular vista. I mean, come on, we're in Colombia. Yeah. That's something you've got to have. And it was economical and, you know, close to the city. And for various reasons, we ended up in this region of San Bernardo. We're driving down the road one day, coming around a corner down a hill, and seeing this beautiful land. And it was just awesome. And I was like, oh my God, if this was for sale, this is the place. And we couldn't find the owner of this finca. And we kept coming back and we asked people, who's the owner of this finca? And we finally found him, an elderly gentleman who lives in Bogota. And we reached out to him. Well, the fun thing was, Richard, you've got to imagine, we're walking up this driveway to this old, you know, finca, like a colonial era finca. And we're coming up the hill, and all around the veranda are art posters that have been in the sun so many years that they have faded to blue and black, of Matisse and Picasso and other modernists. And I'm like, this is a sign. This is the place. And sure enough, we spoke with the owner, and he's like, yes, I want to sell. But it's an enormous finca. We didn't have the money to buy it. In fact, that's our big, big challenge. But he agreed to lease us the place. And so we moved in a little more than close to 2 years ago into the place now. It's an enormous former coffee plantation of about 286 or 100 acres or 116 hectares. And we've been here, and the program has started, and it's been absolutely wonderful.
Incredible. I mean, so it's a proper search that took place. And if you're in that southern area of Cundinamarca, it's the first, these towns represent the first wave of coffee growing towns. So I assume it was, you know, a coffee growing area. You've still got coffee plants on the property and the views. And I imagine, how long had he had it sort of, this finca, the owner, had he had it empty?
Well, what's interesting is I've been told by local historians that this area was actually the original cafetera of Colombia. You know, we think of Quindío, but evidently this area was the place, and it was comprised of six enormous fincas. And this finca, called Finca Australia, was one of those.
Yeah.
And indeed, you know, in the house, we've got these antique machines from, like, you know, 1880. We have a toaster from Paris. We've got an old grinder from Scotland, the original equipment. But evidently, about 50 years ago, the market for coffee plummeted. And a lot of these landowners repurposed the land for cattle. And so, in fact, our land has, you know, does have a cattle ranch on it. But indeed, you walk in the woods and there's coffee plants everywhere.
Well, this is it. I mean, this is the first area of coffee. The Quindío, Risaralda, and Caldas. That's the second zone of coffee, really, although that they've made their name around it. And how far are you from Viota and places like that? Because it's all connected. Not just cattle farming, of course. The southern Cundinamarca has all sorts of problems, as we know, Colombian problems. But so, I mean, so you got your hands on this property and you've done some work to it, and you've had guests. I assume that this, you know, you obviously charge a fee because you've got to make ends meet, and the guests come, and it's a creative experience there in the beautiful countryside outside of out there in San Bernardo.
Yes, and in fact, yes, we have an artist residency program for both Colombian artists and international artists. And our devious plan, I'll be quite frank, is that the international artists pay a certain fee. Mm. And for an international artist, the fee we charge is super, super reasonable. We provide all meals, a beautiful private room, an enormous studio that we built, and an exhibition space and these sorts of things. So it's wonderful for international artists. And yet, because of the difference of economy of Colombia, it makes it extremely affordable for us to be able to extend invitations at a much lower cost to Colombian artists.
So and prior to March to 2020, how was it going?
Wonderful. We had over 100 artists, various creatives, musicians, writers, painters during the first year.
Nice.
We really had our objective was to create energy, and indeed we did. And this really wild, crazy thing happened in March, and that is, you know, I'm watching the news every day, like everyone, and I'm like, wow, this pandemic, it's kind of serious. And for some reason, I had to go into Bogota. And we went in, and we were in Chapinero, and one of my favorite places, Masa, was empty at middle of the day. And I'm like, oh, my God, we're taking it seriously.
Yeah.
And Colombians, they hadn't closed yet. They had not had their first fatality in Colombia at that point, no reported fatalities. Mm-hmm. And we said, okay, we've got to close the center. But we put out word, because a lot of our former guests and artists were still traveling around Colombia. And we put the word out that, hey, if you can get to the center by the 19th, you can come and be in quarantine with us. Otherwise, we're closing the doors. And so on March 20th, we had 13 people in total.
Wow.
And so it was quite a group of people. Little by little, over the month, someone would get a flight back to Germany or Holland, you know, humanitarian flight. So the numbers dwindled until last month, the last four people left. But it was actually a good 6 month period where we were super, super busy. People were making art. We were doing exhibitions, even if no one could see them but us. inside concerts, and we took up, like a lot of the world, we took up bread baking with a masa madre that is still going on today, and probably did a lot of wonderful work in helping to refine our processes for the future.
Well, you should have said, I live 102 blocks from Massa. You should have said you were there in town. I would have come down and helped you fill a table. And so, but yeah, I know the feeling, because here in Bogota, we watched everything close down and we watched the people off the streets. And then, it was getting eerie. And I'm sure to surround yourself, 13 people in a beautiful hacienda, you never felt alone and you felt incredibly safe. I mean, you locked yourself up from the world, but with the kind of people that you want to be locked up with.
Exactly. It was really, you know, as so many people out there were suffering, I was super reluctant to put out there in social media and whatnot, oh my God, we're in paradise here. Mm.
Yeah, this is true.
People, wonderful food and everything.
Well, I mean, and also, well, yeah. Now I understand, and I read a piece in the Bogota Post about this lockdown, and you talk about being fascinated by trauma. A perfect moment for you to be studying trauma from March onwards and even to the current day. And I think it's going to extend much further. I don't want to be so negative, but I don't see 2021 being, you know, the grand panacea, you know, and everything resolved. And the trauma will continue, I would say, generations. I mean, you know, my 5-year-old hasn't really, he doesn't absorb totally what's going on. He knows he's not at school. And my 9-month or 10-month old son is born at the beginning of the pandemic. And wow. You know, these are kids who will, you know, you'll say, my youngest will say, yeah, I was born in 2020, and he'll always make a reference to it. I remember my dad discussing when he was a child, remembering the Great Depression. I mean, he was in Canada. He remembers it being on the radio, you know, these significant moments in life. And of course, the 5-year-old, he'll remember this, the year that he didn't go to school. So in your studies of trauma, what being out there in the Hacienda or Finca Australia, what has been your conclusions, or what have you discovered during this time?
Well, first of all, in all fairness, I'm an artist. I'm not a clinical psychologist, but I have done my fair share of reading on the topic of trauma. And, you know, it's funny, anytime you're, you know, in the United States, we have a certain amount of trauma, I think, from generation after generation of warfare. Fathers have come home, mm-hmm. and now mothers are coming home from the Gulf or whatnot, and they've had these horrible experiences. And in fact, it was during the Gulf War period that the United States military started investing an enormous amount of resources into research around trauma and understanding it better. So a lot of the literature on trauma has really been quite revealing. And one aspect of trauma studies is the idea is that it can be passed genetically onto the next generation. It can be passed, you know, if you're around somebody who's experienced first degree type of PTSD, you start to take on a lot of the symptoms yourself. You're walking on eggshells. You're not sure, you know, I have to be careful about making noise or something. And this creates what clinicians call a second degree of PTSD. And when you think about that nature of PTSD and you think about the quantity or the percentage of the population in Colombia born before 10 years ago who firsthand experienced trauma, pretty high percentage of the population. And when you take into account the concept of second degree PTSD, you can almost make a case that the entire population of Colombia has PTSD. That's a pretty big claim.
I don't think it's out of the ordinary. And I've discussed this actually with a psychologist who lives in rural Antioquia, who's been on the show a few times. And she says the whole of Colombia has PTSD. The whole of Colombia requires, psychosocial and psychological help to discuss.
Right.
You know, we go through this situation where on a daily basis, are people, community leaders, social leaders, and so on, or ex-guerrillas, reintegrated combatants, politicians, whatever, being assassinated, murdered, and we just people are shrugging it off, saying, "Yeah, you know, in Colombia, people get killed all the time." That is trauma.
Right, and yet when you talk to people too, and they talk about, "Oh, I had this horrible nightmare that some guys would show up in a truck with guns," you know, even to have those sorts of fantasies or dreams is very indicative of trauma.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this is about genetically passed on trauma. I think there's something to it, and of course, these guys have studied this in depth. I think there's something to it. If you're a nervous person and you have a negative, let's say, pregnancy or something, I'm sure that can affect the health of the fetus and then the baby on the other side. I'm absolutely certain of it. I think as we become more aware of our surroundings and how our behavior affects those around us, I'm absolutely certain of it. And so I would say your studies in trauma and the work that you've been doing is a kind of art therapy out there. And I was just a side anecdote. I remember once in the early 90s meeting an art therapist, and she said I'm an art therapist, and this was something I guess was new, and I figured it was therapy for artists. That conversation didn't go very long. But I would say what you're offering is a kind of art therapy out there on the Finca.
Well, and a lot of people have made the case that art, and when I say art, I'm including all making activities, music and theater, and, you know, all of these things, is fundamentally therapeutic.
Yeah.
And on different levels, you know, as a maker, you go into what creative psychologists have called, you know, the flow. You're getting into the flow, and it changes. So, you know, in a traumatic situation, you're caught in loops. And these things enable you to help you break those loops. And as audiences, you know, for instance, we had a group who came to the center and worked on a Mozart opera for 2 weeks. And then we gave a concert. We always make our concerts open and free to the community. And the idea of a young person coming and hearing Mozart, well, gee, maybe it won't change their life, but in a small way, they're being exposed to another way of thinking, that it relates to Western music and the canon of Western music. And so they're not just knowing their cultural boundaries, but they're becoming aware of other cultural things, and it expands the mind's ability to think. So in a lot of different ways, you know, people make the case for art being therapeutic. And I believe that. I wish I had more research to back it up, to share with people. But everything in the literature I've seen points to it.
There's an interesting topic you touched on there. You open your concerts to the local people. How are those received? Do you get a lot of interaction with the locals in San Bernardo?
We do. And it's been an interesting adventure in and of itself. There are certain people, we've had like the old campesino sitting there listening to some wild cello funk music, just shaking their head going, "This isn't vallenato. I'm not interested in this." And there's been other people who are just like, "Wow, this is cool. This is different." And they come back. And the other fabulous thing that we've, you know, a lot of different aspects of our work with the community, we really don't want to be colonialist. We take that concept super important. How do we come into a different country and a different culture with, we're bringing art and culture, and yet not be colonialist? What are the secrets of approaching it differently? So we work really hard at that. And our work in the community is really one in this stage is based more on listening and having conversations and not telling people, "Gee, you shouldn't burn plastic in your garbage," but more leading the way and, "Gee, this is what we do, and no, we don't burn plastic, and we're working at zero waste," and these sorts of things. But we have discovered small groups of young people in the community. One is based on feminism. One is based on LGBTQ. Another is based on animal rights. And we were really amazed to find in this extremely rural Campesino community, these small groups of young people thinking differently and having their own struggles within this community for their ways of thinking.
That's interesting. I take on board this very much. And when we started out in Montpaus, I was like, I'm not going to shove my politics and my practices down anyone's throats. I'm just going to do what we do. And I think your example of not burning plastic, for example, is hopefully over time, for example, my neighbors will pick up on what I'm doing, and it will just be a natural progression of one thing. And I do know, for example, like my neighbors are no longer throwing their trash in the river.
Nice.
But, you know, it's a big deal because it's always been the practice. The river just takes it away. It's always been the press. We now have waste collection in Montpaus, but until then, people would just walk out, I mean, and brazenly, not thinking about it, you know, toss their pizza box over the river.
Right.
To me, you know, with my Northern European sensibilities, it was just like, oh, but it's like, I'm not going to say anything. What I'll do is work with, for example, started with my in-laws. It's like, you know, say, we can't do that. We can't do that straight, you know, and they learn, and then they told their cousins, and they told their cousins' cousins, and it's little thing. But that, as you say, the colonial side of things, you need to be so careful. We are immigrants, but we are also guests, and we need to know this.
Yes, exactly.
Do they treat you as the weird gringo who's decided to move out to the country?
Oh yes, definitely. And I was hoping, I had one crazy fantasy at the beginning of the pandemic that this face mask and a hat, people wouldn't notice me as a gringo walking down the street. And that's a ridiculously stupid fantasy because I stick out like a sore thumb no matter what. You know, I'm 6'1"
yeah.
And I'm gringo. And yes, I frequently, you know, in a way it's a little annoying to be objectified, but of course, you know, other groups of people have always had to endure that. And I'm just getting what other people have endured all over the place. But you know, yes, I'm the gringo.
Have you ever considered that you are exotic?
I don't, of course, you know, we're the center of our own consciousness. I'm perfectly normal, you know, but yes, of course I'm exotic. And I will say that I think we're blessed to, because in many parts of the world, to be gringo is a deficit in the social capital column. And Colombia, I think, is one of the few places in the world where being gringo is still a positive. Mm-hmm. Social capital. Automatically, I'm treated well by a lot of people.
Now, as you say, a lot of your assimilation is done by listening. You haven't got involved in local politics or anything, have you?
We avoid local politics like the plague.
Yeah.
You know, we are an entidad sin ánimo de lucro. We're a nonprofit foundation. And, you know, we did have some politicians come visit us early on when there was an election, and I think they wanted us to join them and to do videos at the center, kind of highlighting their progressive thinking. And we sort of like, hey, you know, we don't want to be involved in politics. And I think it gave us a little black mark in that column, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, yeah, because the thing is, the idea is that politics is the only way to solve things. And it, in again, my small town, very similar. You know, we have to campaign, and we have to get involved. Otherwise, the politicians won't do anything. And I generally always said, listen, politicians and central government will help those who help themselves. So, you know, it's not for the politicians, despite the inherent corruption everywhere from top to bottom. It's not for the politician. We shouldn't be doing that. We can look after, and I'll go back to the waste disposal thing because it was the most pressing issue. We can bag our own waste and we can make sure. And once that is seen by the politicians, then they can, you know, take on the mantle and claim it as their own. And right. as soon as we start looking after the road, or, you know, the they call it a trocha, then they'll see that it's been looked after. And so it's, you know, we've done 60% of the work, then the politicians will come in and then say they did it. And that's fine, so long as something's getting done. And I will not get involved in local politics at all. I think, as we sort of mentioned previously, local politics is so very dangerous and so very divisive, and it's so close as well. And you're living in that community. You don't want to get involved. So I think, just step carefully around it. And of course, you may have made some, I think, indifferent reactions to your presence there by not being involved, but in the long term, it's definitely positive.
Right. And I think when we've explained that, hey, you know, we're a nonprofit, we have to avoid that, that's accepted.
Okay. And so, you know, what are we looking at for the future now? Obviously, you're down to, I don't know how many people you are now at this present time in Arte Suma Paz. Who are you sharing the house with right now?
Well, right now we're just staff. Uh-huh. So myself and the general manager. But we've started to take this break and let's step back and look at the future. And, you know, there's a lot of indicators out there that the epidemic will last well into 2021. I think the CEO of one of the major airlines said that he didn't think things would get back to normal till 22. So we're looking at that going, oh my God, you know, how are we going to continue to function? And one of the things we did was we designed residencies with the epidemic in mind. And so what that's going to mean is that they're longer. People need to come for a minimum of 2 months, but maybe 3 months. And the 2 weeks of that time when they first arrive will be in a form of quarantine. Now, quarantine at Arte Suma Paz is super wonderful. Every single room has a door to the veranda, and you've got all this nature, and you have your studio space. And, you know, the common area, the one common area where we serve food, people have to do social distancing and wear masks and all that sort of stuff. So we've designed a program where people can still come, spend a little bit of short time in quarantine, but then the community can reopen and we're in a bubble.
Yeah, definitely. So, and of course, you are managing expectations, and I'm sure focusing on the national market for this period.
Well, and that's a different type of challenge because, of course, if somebody comes from Bogota, it's difficult to impose the quarantine. So it's a challenge. We're still sorting it out. We try to make at least for this coming year where we have three spaces for international artists, and we're starting to fill those. And we always want to create that extra space for a Colombian artist.
Definitely so. And you've been holding solo exhibitions there, pretty much for yourself, it seems.
Well, I did because I have this enormous body of work. I had everything shipped here in a container. And so I have a lifetime of large scale paintings in the studio. And a lot of times as a painter, it's nice to be able to step back and look at your own work. So here I am with this enormous studio space and exhibition space, and I put on exhibit of my own work primarily for myself, just as a means of stepping back and looking at the work and sort of thinking about my own life and my own place in life as an artist.
The evolution of your work. I mean, I think that's one of the most interesting things for artists, musicians, and so on, is to see how you progressed, regressed, just changed.
Sure, definitely. Sure. You know, it's fun. Sometimes you look back at work that maybe you kind of cringed at in your imagination, and you get it on the wall, and you're like, well, hey, that's not so bad. It's got some good things going on there. And we've also, by the way, been making use of these virtual exhibition spaces. And we did a virtual exhibition of the artists who were in quarantine, for instance, with us. And those are a pretty nice way, at least for the moment, of still sharing work.
Excellent. Well, I trust that things open up at some point, at least, you know, even if things open up by 20%, I'm sure you're going to get further visitors to the Hacienda, to the Finca Australia there. And for anyone out there listening who's considering I would say an artist retreat of this nature, of course, check out Rick's website. That's artesumapaz.com. That's artesumapaz, or Z, I guess, .com. And you can see the beautiful surroundings and, of course, the accommodations offered to you, and great photographs of people enjoying communal meals where, I guess, you discuss the highs and lows of the day and what you plan on doing. It's, you know, an area to throw ideas around, and I assume nothing's off the table.
Well, no, nothing is off the table. By the way, one minor correction to that .org.
Oh, .org. Definitely. Well, we'll put it up on the Facebook site, and of course it will be promoted on our Twitter as well. So check that out. And well, listen, I wish you all the best in these challenging months ahead. And I hope that you can get some more artists from Bogota and around to come down and spend time. So at the very least, you can host an area that's sort of intentional for art of all types, and indeed, hopefully make ends meet, because I think that's one of the key goals at this moment in time. We're not looking at making money. We're looking at just being able to pay our staff and feed ourselves, I think.
Exactly. and you know, if I might add,
please,
and hopefully if I add too much, you can edit. But another aspect of the project is we have a vision that is so much more ambitious than the artist residency program that we have now. And part of that was influenced by the land itself. You know, throughout the world, the United States and Europe, Japan, you've got these incredible, what are frequently called art parks or sculpture parks. Mm. In New York, we've got Storm King. It's one of the most incredible places to visit in New York. And when you stand at the Finca and look out over the valley, and you imagine, what if we could place large-scale sculptures there and there, that this could potentially have the potential of being one of the most important cultural tourism destinations of Colombia. So it's an enormous, enormous dream of ours. It's probably going to represent our largest fundraising effort. We also have a nonprofit, a 501c3 in the United States in order to do that. But we're setting out to acquire the land and an adjoining finca and create an enormous sculpture park unlike anything that exists in this country.
Yeah, we've got a small one in Barichara, of course, but I think you're looking at something bigger, aren't you?
Yes, much bigger scale.
Well, again, I say I wish you all the best. It's a challenging time, but like I said, you seem to be in the right place. It seemed to be somewhere that you feel very much at home and at peace in. I can hear it in your voice, and you've become part of the community, and by not making waves in the community, as in politics, of course, very presence there has created a ripple, but you're not making waves. I think this is all points towards a brighter future, and of course a great let's say direction for creativity in the area.
Well, thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me on the Columbia Calling.
No.
Like I said, it's a real honor. you spoke a little deprecatingly of your podcast, but as I said, it's been a big influence for me in moving to Colombia.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be English if I wasn't self-deprecating. So, But thank you so much for your time. And I know you've had to come out of the finca and go down into town for connection. So that's another plus, I think, for the Hacienda, the finca, is that you're probably out of internet and cell phone range, which can in itself just be wondrous in this day and age.
Exactly. Yes.
So I've been speaking to Rick Dragon, artist, former digital marketing entrepreneur, and of course, executive director and co-founder of Arte Suma Paz. And of course, he's on Instagram as well, Arte Suma Paz. You can see the photos of the work being done, people enjoying themselves, creativity in progress. So be sure to check out the website. And if you've got time and you want to head down there, just look it up and get in touch. And I'm sure the gates will open for you and there will be somewhat of a quarantine. But hey, isn't that the norm right now? So we're signing off for this week. I've been Richard McCall for this episode of the Columbia Calling podcast. Thank you so much for listening. As always, share, spread the word, keep up the good work, and stay safe, everyone. This virus isn't going away. Does seem that we're heading towards another lockdown if we just look at Europe and what's going on in North America. So again, I said, we can't insist enough. Stay safe. Don't do anything you don't need to be doing at this time. So anyway, that's me signing off. Farewell. Bye-bye.